We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome on in. This is the conference championship edition of the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. We're going to unpack all of the divisional round action and dive into both the AFC and the NFC championship matchups. It's going to be a great show. Let's get it rolling. Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast, NFL Conference Championship Weekend upcoming. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. Mario, we had some breaking news come across shortly before we sat down to record this fine episode here. Nathaniel Hackett, famous friend of the pod, guy that we've been big,
mentor,
big proponents of.
Probably, you'd say.
Yeah. All the above. So he has been tabbed as the new OC for the New York Football Jets. Your thoughts?
Man, it's a lot to sort out, and I would wonder, how this happened. It's not obvious to me that this would be for any particular reason necessarily. Like, it could be for a variety of reasons, and it could, of course, be as simple as what I would imagine most people are kind of flocking to right now, which is, looks like the Jets are trying to get Aaron Rodgers, or they're putting the option on the table for themselves, at least. I don't know. That could be the case. It could be some kind of, they view it as like, well, we got to fill the offensive coordinator role with somebody. Why not? Let's see if we can make a pick that also gets us, that increases our odds or something of getting Rodgers, or I don't know. It's possible that it's that. It's possible that it's that with the approval of Robert Saleh. It's also possible that it's that without the approval of Robert Saleh. Like, this could be Joe Douglas acting over Robert Saleh without Saleh's input, which I wouldn't be surprised if it's the case. It could be either one. I mean, Saleh could be fine with it too. Especially with how desperate he probably is at this point. Like, he's not maybe more of like a beggar than he might have been a couple of years ago. But I don't know. I mean, I think Saleh, he's kind of like a no-nonsense kind of, I don't know. I could imagine him having some slightly, as most jocks, I can have imagine him having some slightly reactionary opinions about social norms or whatever. I could see him not really getting along with a bubbly, sweet, just kind of a silly goose of a man that Nate Hackett is. So I don't know. They don't seem like a great personality type fit to me exactly, but maybe they can just work in different labs and never really have to deal with each other that much. I don't know. I am more skeptical of Joe Douglas than a lot of people, so I wouldn't be surprised if this was basically done without Saleh's input, or if it was sort of
hey, we're doing this.
Yeah, it's like Saleh can't do anything about it. Douglas is the GM. He is basically his boss, even though Joe Douglas is, you might wonder, like, what did Joe Douglas do to somebody's boss. Like, I don't know, not doing a great job as far as I can tell, but that's how the world works, guys. who are very dumb tell masses of people to do things for them, and we have to do that because that's the way the world works. I don't know what it, you know, if we say, yeah, they trade for Aaron Rodgers this offseason, and for some reason the Hackett hiring, you know, makes that more likely for the Jets, makes it more possible for the Jets, then I guess, you know, what's the harm? I mean, this isn't the first time Hackett's been an offensive coordinator either. I think to varying levels of success, he was the offensive coordinator with the Packers. He probably wasn't the play caller, but he was with the Jaguars, I think, under Doug Marrone. And those Bortles offenses, it's like, I don't know, they're bad for the most part, of course, but I don't know how much of that had to do with Hackett specifically. My take on Hackett as a schemer is that he's one of these guys who he probably is a decent positional coach or whatever. He probably runs a decent practice. He probably teaches the concepts basically well, but I don't think he's a thinker of any sort. Like I would imagine he's just the kind of a good soldier coach who's just sort of learned from his dad the way you're supposed to do it. And he believes in truisms, and he believes in sayings like, this is the way you do it. And he doesn't consider the possibility that the thing that he's been taught to do is not the only way to do something. And so I doubt he has any sort of like, I doubt he has any kind of like insight or adaptability. I think he just kind of was taught a certain system, is competent at running that kind of system for the most part, but can't do anything else and can't elevate anyone. And so beyond greasing the track or whatever to get Rodgers as a pickup, I don't really see any sort of like plus utility from Hackett, but it is possible that, you know, now that he's not a head coach, now that he doesn't have the authority that he did with the Broncos, maybe he goes from, you know, a horrible net effect on a team to, you know, barely noticeable one.
So in the event that they don't pull off a Rodgers move, I guess we're assuming that they will have a quarterback other than Zach Wilson next year, but say it's not Aaron Rodgers, like, is he going to be able to get enough out of this offense? I mean, it seems like outside of quarterback, there is enough there for the Jets to, you know, have a competent, you know, offensive system. But, you know, can he pull that off?
Right. I was actually pretty low on Michael LaFleur. He's really young, so I wouldn't be surprised if he gets better at some point. It's easy to forget. Sean Payton, when he was much younger, was the offensive coordinator for the Giants and had his play calling taken away by Jim Fossil, and Peyton eventually still turned into a guru type. So maybe Matt LaFleur, is it Mike or I can't even Mike LaFleur? Matt LaFleur
Mike is the
Packer. Mike LaFleur, the younger one who doesn't even look like the other LaFleur. He might turn out okay despite getting fired for Nate Hackett, but I do think the Jets showed some kind of alarming personnel judgment on offense. And I think LaFleur was the kind of guy to sort of hear about or read about some cool cutting edge thing and then just kind of like indulge the premise without really mastering it before. And specifically, he had a couple good ideas. Like, he was really committed to running up tempo, and he really believed in like stressing the defense with tempo. And I certainly believe in that too. But he wasn't really, he wasn't spending enough time, in my opinion, looking at the sum of personnel that he had and make like an honest effort to figure out the way to maximize all of it cumulatively. I think he more so just kind of would go, you know, go into the office thinking like, we got to get this guy. We got to get Braxton Berrios the ball. We got to get Braxton Berrios going. Like, no, you don't. If you think that, you're lost. You got to go back to work, you know, start over. So he'll have the chance to grow from it and come back a better version of himself. But I wouldn't be surprised if Hackett is kind of like a better, or like not better overall, certainly not better in the long term. But in the meantime, he might have some sort of kind of stabilizing effect that LaFleur might otherwise struggle to establish. Oh, the other thing, LaFleur being the kind of guy to believe in like hot hand logic, hot hand, whatever, at approach at running back, and being convinced that Zonovan Knight was better than Michael Carter. Like, man, you just saw these guys playing in the same conference like a year and a half ago. No one watching North Carolina and North Carolina State had any trouble telling who was better between Michael Carter and Zonovan Knight. But LaFleur Maybe it was just out of desperation. Like maybe he didn't believe it either. Maybe he was like, I don't even think Knight's any good, but I'm just going to mash any button that I can to get a better result than what we've gotten. That's kind of one of the, that's one of the things that's like, yeah, fair enough, I guess. But also that's not good enough. You know, you gotta
right.
come up, you gotta scrape something together better than I press the other button. What do you want me to do? So I think Hackett could bring more like fundamental soundness, if nothing else. And if he's calling plays, I mean, he'll probably be some version of not good, but the truth is most play callers in the NFL are some version of not good. So it in the end, it probably won't be a big deal is my guess. I mean,
okay. Understood. Well said all around. It doesn't really move the needle for me too much either. And then one more OC note or discussion point. If you were the Ravens, who would your wish list be?
I don't know. It's almost got to be someone from like the college ranks or something. And I don't. I don't know. I feel like the answer is likely to be someone that Harbaugh doesn't necessarily have access to, and so I don't know what's the answer going to be. If it's you can only choose from people who you know. Are 2 degrees removed from Stanford coaching trees or something, which is apparently the main criterion, or else I don't know how else Greg Roman stuck around this long. But I've said before, my dream coach for Lamar Jackson would actually be Chip Kelly. So what I think would get Lamar the best return for his abilities is an up-tempo approach. The tempo is just for both for like a general source of stress for the defense and because it's specifically a way to test their conditioning depth in the run game. And so, you know, in the Greg Roman offense, it's a problem to have J.K. Dobbins and Gus Edwards and get them enough work. In a Chip Kelly offense, they both get enough work because you're getting to the line so much faster. You're snapping so many more plays that you do need 2 15-carry running backs. It's not like you have two capable of taking 15-plus carries and you have, you know, just 15 each, maybe 12 to 15 each game to get between the two. With Chip Kelly or somebody like that, you'd be testing that run strain that Lamar, of course, presents. And those running backs, I think, with tempo at their side can you know, maximize their usage and efficiency both. And then I want to play off that threat. Big, fast at receiver, tight end, striking downfield when it's there. But, you know, you run to get those corners up and then you go deep. That kind of thing. And I think Chip Kelly does all that stuff really well. I thought Greg Roman couldn't have been much worse at it. So in a way, I think almost anyone would be an upgrade. But I am worried. It's like, what if it's going to be like David Shaw's quarterbacks coach or
that
some
would
crap
be,
like that?
I would be.
So, yeah, it's either that or it's going to be like some Cam Cameron doofus, you know, some guy who was like a failed offensive coordinator who started as a quarterbacks coach in the 90s that John Harbaugh still has in his Rolodex. And it is a Rolodex, John. And yeah. I don't know what, again, I do believe that just about anybody would be better than Roman, but I am also getting like preemptively angry about how unnecessarily weak whatever the hiring will turn out to be. Like if it's somebody who's, I'm just terrified it's going to be, I guess they already did Morning Wig, didn't they? So they can't do Morning Wig. Yeah. Marty Morning
Marty
Wig.
Ball.
It literally happened. I don't know, man. I hope it's someone chip brain, someone like that, but I don't know who that even is.
I was trying to come up with like a chip in the brain joke, but and then I've seen some fanfic about Bobby Petrino, who actually just got hired by Texas A&M to be their offensive coordinator. The Ravens scooping in and poaching him. Obviously, he is connection to Lamar from the Louisville days. That would be interesting. And then as far as like the realistic options, I've seen the guy who took over play calling in Denver the last couple of weeks of the season. That's an awfully small sample to be working
that?
With. I don't know. I don't
I thought
know
it was
his
like
name
that
off the top
of my head. Roseburg consultant guy or whatever.
Well, whoever right. it was, I mean, the Denver's offense looked better. It you know, again, we're measuring against couldn't be much worse. So, you know, that how much can you really extrapolate from that? But I don't know that I was a little bit more encouraged by like just the mystery box that than like the rusted out boat that would be like a Frank Reich or something.
Yeah, I'd hate that. I would be better at answering this question if I knew as much about college football coaches as you, but I think somebody who's part of a system that is spread oriented at the collegiate level and shows like a grasp of the passing game, but also that kind of like, Chip Kelly and this other guy's Satan, of course, but Art Briles, like that kind of offense where at Baylor, where it was like, they actually run the ball a ton, but they run so many plays that people mistake them for a pass happy offense just because they'd also have a bunch of games where they get to like 35, 40 pass attempts. But the reason they did that was because they were pushing for like 80, 82 plays a game. So I think that kind of mentality is what would that kind of thinking is what suits the abilities best of Lamar. So someone of that kind of background, I'd be willing to, take a gamble on almost blindly because, the candidates that are known, the list that might actually exist, it's not really interesting to me.
All right. We need Baltimore to go check in at UTSA and see see if their OC would be
is
interested.
What about that Tulane guy? Is that Fritz? He always seems to win a lot.
Willie Fritz. Yeah, no, he's kind of old though.
I know he's old as hell. He's like 80. But, I don't know. Maybe that's exactly what they need. Is like a they need the kind of football coach who's old and still, like they need a Johnny Cash kind of coach who's 80 but still listens to Nine Inch Nails. That kind of guy.
Yes. Okay. All right. So we have our vision board set. We'll see if the execution can be made by Eric DaCosta and company. Let's go ahead and move on. Do a little postmortem on some of the teams that bowed out gracefully or not so gracefully last weekend. Start with the Jaguars. Kind of your 10,000 foot view on their season. What needs to happen for them this offseason?
Yeah, they need downfield targets on offense. They need a 25-snap running back who is not Jamichael Hasty. They presumably could do better at one or two offensive line spots, maybe. I don't know. Defense, I don't know what to make them Caldwell, that defensive coordinator they hired from Tampa Bay. Like, there were times when their defense looked so bad and then other times where you almost maybe started to see them kind of catch on with these – ambitious concepts. Like the Caldwell defense was pretty ambitious in its like complexity, so sometimes schemes like that, especially when there's personnel turnover in addition, it can take a while for them to start playing well together, even if they're capable of it. So I wouldn't be surprised if Caldwell get to year two or three as a coordinator. Maybe he can really take off when he has that much time to that much continuity among his personnel. So their defense might be on the right track, despite, in my opinion, looking pretty bad most of the year. And at the very least, they need another corner. I would say they could use better linebackers, but Trent Baalke already spent so much there that they can't do anything there forever now. So they're spending a ton of money in draft capital at linebacker for probably at best like average returns. That's a pretty big setback. They need a lot more in the pass rush, actually. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Trayvon Walker just kind of goes nuts someday, but he's still very young and he's still like unrefined. So they can't really count on him to be like, they need him to be like an occasional sort of like force of nature, not like a play to play kind of like, anchor of the defense. And, there's something going there. I mean, I like Doug enough. He over the course of the year showed the ability to kind of figure things out, which sounds like a low bar, but it's really not, or at least it's something you can't take for granted with most of these coaches. Doug, he might have a wrong idea, but when he sees it doesn't work, he won't say, "Guess the players failed me." Like he'll say like, "Okay, guess we'll try something else." Then most coaches just go, I got to get these guys suck. I need better players. It's like Doug at least goes like, well, what are these guys even good at? And we'll, be open to new ideas over the course of the year. But they got to get Marvin Jones off the field. If they had DJ Chark instead of Marvin Jones this year, there's a chance they beat the Chiefs. Like they really would have had a shot. But there's right now no vertical element in the the Jaguars offense. The
vertical Ridley element, doesn't fix that necessarily, does he?
No, he doesn't. And what he does, I will say, he definitely is so much better than Marvin Jones that it'll have like a transformational effect anyway.
Sure.
But the way you get Trevor Lawrence to really go insane is you got to give him the vertical threat, because Lawrence will toy with the defense, and he's got a little bit of like that Mahomes kind of thing where he'll toy with the defense and he can just kind of access any level of the defense. He can set up throwing pockets from anywhere. He can move, you know, set up a new pocket somewhere else. And so he doesn't even need like freak receivers so much as he just needs someone who can get to a point B in a certain amount of time that he can, you know, calibrate in his head and develop a rhythm in response to. So in the case of Mahomes, all he really needs is Valdez-Scantling. And Valdez-Scantling, his speed dictates certain reactions and alignment details from the defense, which Mahomes can look at pre-snap, and he can't really make Mahomes can't make Valdez-Scantling like a star receiver, but he can use him to figure out so many things and dictate so many things that from that point, it just becomes a matter of like Mahomes's judgment, and given his ability to access any part of the field and his ability to almost always correctly deduce things, like he just puts up numbers automatically, even with receivers who aren't really stars. And I think Trevor Lawrence can absolutely be that same sort of thing, but they still don't have the speed. The speed is Jamal Agnew, who plays 15 snaps a game and gets like 5 targets and 3 carries on those 15 snaps. So it's like,
right,
he goes
it's
in
a
the
huge
game.
Tell.
Yeah, the defense just immediately is like, hey, they put in Agnew, let's kill him. Like, they will never be wrong for gunning straight at him when he's on the field. So anyway, they've got some good personnel. It's like Christian Kirk, I think, is the real deal, and they still use him too much. They were too dependent on him as a vertical threat. Like, they still wouldn't use Evan Ingram downfield, which I still don't agree with. I think that guy should be running basically just posts, corners, and drag routes from wide alignments. He should not be running anything that brings him back facing toward the quarterback. He should never be, he should never be like running a curl at any depth. And the longer the depth, the better to me. His 4.42 40 was the fastest on the offense, and yet they kept him usually around like 6-7 yards of the line of scrimmage. So when your vertical threat is Christian Kirk or Travis Etienne, you as a defense you rule out certain concerns that you might have with other offenses who could threaten you vertically, and you start to it just makes the game harder on Lawrence the same way it makes the game harder on Justin Herbert with the Chargers. Like, if the defense literally does not have to worry about defending the length of the field, then they won't do it. And if they only have to defend like 8-10 yards, any defense would tell you that's much easier than 15-20, et cetera. So they need some vertical element. And if they're not going to bench Zay Jones, then I don't know how they're going to get it exactly out of Ridley. But I really wish they would just phase out. The way to maximize Ridley and Kirk and Lawrence is to basically phase out Zay Jones next year and put in like a 500-400 snap, just, I don't know, burner or you know, ideally tall burner, who you can use like the Valdez-Scantling kind of like decoder personnel before the snap.
Yeah, so they definitely need to add that speed element, get a little bit more complete in the receiving core. You think they bring back Ingram?
It would be a bad idea, I think. So yes, it's gonna be cost prohibitive, but Balky, he's an idiot. He's a vain moron, and he will see the relative success that the Jaguars had at the end of the year and the relative success that Ingram had in that stretch as a vindication of him, Trent Balky. He will begin to see Evan Ingram not just as whatever he is, but like a monument to his own self, Trent Balky. And I think that vanity will lead him to indulge a contract that Ingram is not worth. And I think it'll kind of set them back a little bit, but hopefully not too much. I still think Ingram could be more productive yet, to be clear. Like, I think he's still not quite being used the right way. So, and you know what? In a way, he could still be that vertical threat that I'm talking about. Even Ingram, even though he's not Valdez-Scantling, even though he's not a 4-3 guy, having a 230-pound route runner who's running a low 4-4, if the safety has him run at him a couple times, he'll start noticing him the way that he would Valdez Scantling, because it sucks when you're surprised by, you look out of the corner of your eye and you just notice this 230-4.4 guy running at you full speed. Being caught off guard like that will give you a heart attack, and you'll keep an eye on him from the rest of the way. But if he's running curls, running drags, it's like, yeah, you're instead going like, where's Kirk? Let's bracket Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they got to get a little bit more multiple out there. Let's move on to the Giants. They got some key free agent decisions to make, obviously. But beyond that, what's kind of your view of this season for them? Do they need to stand pat and or bite the bullet and sign Daniel Jones to a fairly big deal or, market rate deal type of deal?
That'd be a disaster. If it's one of those funny money things where it's basically a 1 or 2 year deal, then whatever, sure. I guess you could do worse than Daniel Jones, but I am a little irritated with some of the Daniel Jones apologia that we're seeing. It's like it's one of those things where, like, everyone has low expectations for him, and then when he does slightly better, they lose the perspective of the fact that they had lower expectations for him and higher expectations for other quarterbacks, and they'll sort of just talk themselves into thinking that actually Daniel Jones is comparable to these other guys. Like, no, those other guys are only comparable in the sense of, like, your relative expectations. Like, you were relatively surprised and pleased with how Daniel Jones did, so you have this sense in your head of, like, Daniel Jones good, whereas you had higher expectations for whoever. I'm sure there's some lately there's probably a bunch of people who are saying, like, Daniel Jones is better than Dak Prescott or something. So, like, let's use Dak as an example. Like, people expect Dak to be good, and so when he is something more in line with what Daniel Jones usually is, they still can convince themselves, like, Daniel Jones did better though. Like, no, you have to keep a perspective in mind, and the perspective with Daniel Jones is, this is a guy who has not completed more than 66% of his passes in a year, which was this year, and so it was a career best. And he's never gone over 6.8 yards per attempt, which was also, I think, a career best this year. So if you're in the sub 7 yards per attempt category and you're not completing well over 70% of your passes, you are not just some version of bad. You're a bad that means an offense can't go. Like, it's like trying to say, I don't know. It's like trying to make the, it's trying to say, like, a battery that's completely dead is almost as good as a battery that doesn't have much energy left or something. It's like this is just not good enough. And if just because you could imagine it being a little better with improved receiver personnel doesn't mean then in that case that it would be enough either. Like, this is bottom five in the league type stuff. It's completely unacceptable for any offense to budget passing games, passing returns like Daniel Jones has always had. The one change this year, it wasn't as a passer, really. I mean, he turned the ball over less, I guess you would say, but I think that's largely for structural reasons. I don't think that's because of Jones changing. If you watch the Giants, they throw the ball as little as they can, and they use as much play action as they can on those pass attempts that they do call. And so everything that Jones does is simple. With Dable, Dable looked at Jones, he's like, okay, we got to simplify things. We got to reduce the game for him to basically, like, his toughness and his running ability. And we have to leverage those things as much as we can. And we do that by limiting the interpretation that he has to do. We limit his exposure as his passer. And so you got this setup where, like, the Giants want to throw more, but when they do, they pretty much just have to run more with Jones. And that at once was like it's an example of how Dable's so good. He's practical and pragmatic, but it's also it's like a trick that'll wear out quickly. And you need better personnel to get over to account for the adjustment that's waiting for you. And I think you saw it a little bit in that playoff game. By the way, he had two good games this year, Daniel Jones. Both were against the Vikings.
Yep.
So if someone were to just look at his non-Viking stats this year, they would actually conclude he got worse, or at least his like completion percentage and yards per attempt and touchdown percentage had gotten worse. 15 touchdowns on his pass attempt volume is awful. I should have to back up a bit. To really get a beat on just how ineffective Daniel Jones is as a passer, you have to note the interaction between touchdown percentage, yards per attempt, completion percentage, and field position. And basically, when a quarterback has only 15 touchdowns, And touchdown production is a downward pressure on yards per attempt. If he only has 15 touchdowns and that many pass attempts and then still only has 6.8 yards per attempt, that's a defense beating you with almost out even trying to. Like that is getting so nowhere even close to a competitive level that it's truly harmless. Like, you can't be hurt by that passing game. So if Daniel Jones can keep putting up 700 plus yards rushing every year at 5+ yards a carry, that admittedly would be a little bit of a game changer for him, because you can't scale up his passing. There's nothing to be done. You can hide him. That's it. If you expose him further, you're just going to get wrecked for it. So that's the danger there too. Is like, if they do keep him around and they do get better receivers and they say, hey, Daniel Jones has better receivers, we can throw more now. Guess what? You can't. You still can't throw more. If you might get, you will get better returns on the passing you're doing. But if you try to throw more with Jones, it's just going to go badly. We know that. And I bet too that the fumble count in particular was just kind of a high BABIP thing. Like,
yeah,
if he has like 8 fumbles in his next 10 games, I don't think that should surprise anybody. So, if you're asking like, is Daniel Jones better than like Malik Willis or something? Like, yeah, he's better than that. So I guess if you're phrasing the situation for the Giants as like, are they going to go with Daniel Jones or an absolutely horrendous rookie quarterback?
Yeah.
Like, okay, I guess Jones, but why do we have to limit ourselves to that?
No, exactly. All right. So that's a good, like, kind of cautionary analysis on Jones, because I do feel like the word was perfect, apologia, for Daniel Jones. And, you know, he just simply wasn't
we thought he would be the reason they had a bad year, and he wasn't. So, like, people are just going like, I guess he's good now? Like, you don't have to think that way. You don't have to chase the little – when someone throws the jangling keys, you don't have to run after it.
Right. The Vikings games, too, in particular, like, those do stick out in people's minds. I feel like the one in December
Dable had the Donatel in such a sharpshooter. It's like you could put in – you know, Chase Daniel or whoever, and they would have had about the same result.
So, all right. That's all right. As far as the Giants go, yeah, I think that we will see not a ridiculous contract, or definitely one that's kind of smartly drawn up on the Giants side of things. I think that they probably know deep down that, you know, that this year is about as good as it's going to get for him. It's probably not going to get a ton better. Even if you put better pieces around him. So, yeah, I could see it being something where, like, the guaranteed money runs out by, like, 25 and they're ready to go do something else.
Think of the headlines and, you know, the general tone of around that the contract Rodgers signed, and he's already movable. It's like you heard the contract. It was like, Rodgers and the Packers come to an agreement on, you know, like, 3-year, $150 million contract. And you must think, like, oh, my God. Guaranteed contract, the guaranteed dollars must make it impossible to move that contract. And now here we are in January of 2023. And if the Packers designate Aaron Rodgers as a post June 1st trade, they'll actually save like $1.5 million on the cap. So if you see that if the Giants sign Jones to some kind of like what otherwise seems like impossibly expensive deal, it probably just is not that actual. It's probably not actually that expensive.
Yeah. All right. I definitely see that. Let's open the can of worms that is the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah.
Well.
Oh, you just open already? Okay. I was giving you time to open the can. Yeah.
It's open. It's open. You know, I thought last week's game was inexcusable for the Bills. You know, I think that there's been so much coddling, I guess, of Josh Allen and the Bills. I think that they're a team that the general public can root for, because they've never really gotten to the mountaintop. They've gotten painfully, perilously close. And then, you know, in recent years, after, you know, a really long stretch, like almost 2 decades worth of ineptitude, they have a guy that you could see potentially getting them to that mountaintop in Josh Allen. And, you know, he's made strides from where he was as a rookie and a second year player to where he is now. And you see the game last year, the classic out in Kansas City, the second year in a row that they had lost to Kansas City in the postseason. But it felt like, OK, this is the Bills' year. They go out week one. They just trounce the defending Super Bowl champions in LA. It's like, okay, wheels up. Allen gets hurt, bangs up the elbow against the Jets midseason. Never really recaptures that. But I think that bottom line, the Bills just kind of were built in such a specific way where they weren't able to do anything if plan A didn't work, which was Josh Allen just being Superman, and he wasn't Superman last
plans
week.
A through E or F, I would even say. Like, it's just anytime something goes wrong with them, and I don't know why this didn't strike me as like a more concerning statement when I said it at the time, but on the radio with Jim or Joe, I can't remember, it was like, I just thought, what happens when Josh Allen doesn't go? They always ask Josh Allen to go. They just, mm-hmm. It's like when Josh Allen can't do something, they say, okay, ask Josh Allen to do more then. Like that's, it's just categorically a dead end kind of set of reasoning. And it's, yet it is not unfair to say that's what their actual approach was.
No, it was. And it, you know, that I couldn't quite find a clean search to look this up without having to like go through like every single box score from the year, but the amount of times that he must have been their leading rusher or within a couple yards of leading them in rushing this year must have been about half the games, if not more, not overly sustainable. So they've, you know, I think the argument is going to be that this offseason that, oh, they need a running game, but they just, you know, spent all this draft capital on James Cook. Are they going to get back to it? It's like, well, that's a bad pick. Don't make it worse. Don't compound it by avoiding fixing it. You know, so whether it's free agency or whether it's going for another day two running back, they need something that's more consistent in the backfield to take some of that pressure off of Josh Allen. And then I think the other thing, I don't know, what do we make of Gabe Davis? Have we been kind of like oversold on the weapons that Josh Allen has at his disposal?
I don't think so. I mean, I know people fixate on drops and things like that, but I just don't care. I mean,
one of those plays last week, that was just Cam Taylor-Britt making an incredible play.
Yeah,
the one down the sideline.
I saw people complaining about Gabe Davis, and I'm like, I'm sorry. This is cope. This is tilt by Josh Allen super fans. And if you need to find a culprit out of this group, And if you need to make Gabe Davis of all people the culprit, then you're not even good at finding, you know, the rat in your own crew. It's like it's Isaiah McKenzie who's killing this offense, and it's people won't have, you know, the perspective. They won't do the research, which I understand enough, the research part of it. But it's like if you just look at the Bills' stats for a few seconds, it shouldn't take you long to figure out where the weak link is, and it's not Gabe Davis. Gabe Davis is being misused. I will say that. They're using him in a role that doesn't suit his abilities. And I don't know what the reason is for that exactly. It's like
does Ken Dorsey suck? Is that possible?
So. I mean, or at least I don't know. I have no idea how to tell. And to be fair to Dorsey, they did this under Dable too. They used Davis as like a downfield specialist. And like that, go watch Gabe Davis at UCF. He catches balls all over the place. They use him at all depths, and he was a workhorse receiver, which is to say they had to get him underneath and intermediate targets, which the Bills almost categorically rule him out for. Their approach is basically like, we'll try to get Diggs going at the first two levels, and if he's covered, look for Davis. He's at the third level. And when you run a 4.5/4.40, you can't be a third level specialist. You can be in the third level off of double moves. You can be in the third level in hurry-up situations. You can be in the third level off of play action. If that's your default area of operation, you need to be running a low 4.4. You can't access that depth fast enough to come into play in route progression.
So do you think enough.
Oh, sorry.
Do you think that's an extension of their Josh Allen hubris where it's like, well, he can get to the third level because Josh is going to be, you know, running around trying to extend the plays back there, therefore giving Davis enough time to get to that depth?
Well, I think they're just making a mistake reasoning on Davis's part, and I can understand it enough. I think what they're doing is they're fixating on how he's generally a good jump ball receiver. They're like, hey, he's good at making catches and he's good at, you know, going down the sideline and getting higher in the air than the guy who's on him and bringing down the ball for a cool catch. And That is true. Davis can do that, but it's not the thing you should try to have him do the most. He did a lot of bread and butter type stuff at UCF, and he would be more effective on routes that were more a route tree that was more varied. Like they saw him do a cool thing one time, and they just, you know, they ran with the premise too far. They're like, what if we only did this? And like, yeah, what, that'd be cool if he could just always go and make that catch, but that's not easy to do. And Josh Allen isn't usually throwing that ball. He's usually looking and seeing like, oh, Davis has a guy on him. I should look for Knox or whatever. And in any case, what they should be thinking about is they should stop fixating on this Isaiah McKenzie tiny slot receiver obsession of theirs. Like, that's not helpful to have. They seem committed to the actual archetype too. They're like, we gotta have a 5'8", 180-pound slot receiver. You gotta have those. Like, you could have Gabe Davis run from the slot, and you should. Not all the time, but they should switch it up, is what I'm saying. He's capable of making the downfield play, but only, or rather, most particularly when the defense is concerned about other things too. And at UCF, like, if you didn't cover him underneath or in the intermediate, he'd eat you up there, and then he'd make a big play downfield if you tried to shore up your underneath coverage. Whereas with the Bills, it's more like you just sit deep and wait for him, and you know the ball won't go there very much because Diggs is going to get 12, 15 targets, and McKenzie's going to run 40 useless routes and get, you know, 6 targets himself. So it's like, if you're a defense, you know, like, okay, so for those remaining 12 targets, it's either got to be Knox or Davis. They don't throw to Davis before 15, so don't worry about that. Like, you just start zeroing in on certain tendencies, and you can kind of build a custom defensive scheme in response to the Bills' offense. And I think if you're building it smartly, you can make it really tough on the Bills if you can contain Diggs. Which, I mean, to back up a little bit, I think the Bills were hurt really badly in this game by the snow and the weather,
which is inexcusable.
Right, it's like it's like a conventional excuse for the game going the way it did. But when, you know, Brandon Bean, he's done a good job, I think. But I also think is one of those guys who probably reads like 538. He probably talks with like Thomas Dimitroff or something. Brandon Bean probably has like Eric Eager's phone number or something. You know, these kinds of things. these kinds of red flags. He believes in like Tesla, things like that. So he's susceptible to all like postmodern data brained idiot culture. And, I think you see that in the construction of their offense, which is clearly it's centering on like the theory of like passing game, maximize the passing game. You don't need to run. If you do run, have a tiny running back who sucks so that you're not tempted to run. Yeah, like have tiny running backs who can't do anything, and then that way you won't be tempted into the the sin of running the ball with a good running back that you gave a livable wage. So they're like, we gotta get these crap running backs who suck and catch passes and are tiny and can't do nothing, and that's why they spent that second round pick on James Cook. By the way, to be fair to James Cook, did anyone notice his actual returns as a pass catcher this year? Because
were they not good?
The whole theory with James Cook and the justification for his awful profile and the indefensible selection that the Bills made was that, hey, you know, these dinosaur backs that you guys like so much, these 230-pound dinosaurs who can't catch the dang ball, they're on the way out. This is the new breed. And James Cook is going to fit the NFL even better than he did in college because he's just, like, ahead. He's so ahead of the time. You don't even know he's good, dude, yet. He's like, so ahead of the time. He hasn't even tried to be good yet, and it's going to be nuts when he gets in the NFL where his actual abilities are valued in the future. And he's going to be a great pass catching threat. And you know, this meat-headed stuff that you care about, running for short yardage, running 20 times in a game, that's over, man. We got the new Eckler here in James Cook. And watch this, guys. Oh, what? 32 targets for 180 yards. He caught 21 of 32 targets. That's what is that, like 66%?
Yep, 65.6%, 9.4% drop rate. Really not a whole lot of yards after the catch either.
5.6 yards per target. So 0.656 times 5.6, what is that, like 3.4 or something like that? So if you think of it this way, James Cook was like less effective in terms of per – if you multiply – so I call the I don't know, someone probably calls it like success rate or something like that. But if you take the completion percentage times the yards per target, you get the effect, like the in effect yardage per usage, more fair in my opinion than the yards per target figure, which is just, you know, on the targets. This is accounting for the failure rate, which is a third of the time. And like, think about the cost of that. A third of the time this ball hits the ground, and when you do catch it, it's for 5.6 yards per target. You need to have that up like by 9 or something to be worth it. And by the way, I'm leading into a point that is not that James Cook is a bad pass catcher. I don't even think he is. I think there's something to do with the structure of the Bills offense that makes it impossible for running backs to catch passes. And you saw going into this year, there's a lot of this about Josh Allen needs help from the running backs. Those damn running backs are betraying him, and they're not helping him enough by doing the one thing they're allowed to do, which is catch passes. They shut their mouth and catch passes and never open their mouth. That's what they're okay. That's what it's okay for them to do. Anything else is wrong. And you know, James Cook, thank God, will start correcting that issue. And it's like, maybe it's possible instead. I mean, Devin Singletary is probably a bad pass catcher, and I don't mean him so much, but Zach Moss caught lots of passes at Utah. And what did he do in the Bills offense? Nothing as a pass catcher. So I saw that as concerning for Cook, but this still turned out way worse than I thought it was going to be. I thought Cook was going to be a vague disappointment. I remember that one kid was just saying like, he's going to be rookie of the year because of second round draft capital and the Bills offense. Yeah. Like, yeah. Being able to actually hold the ball is not a prerequisite apparently anymore. But anyway, so Cook can't get the ball as a pass catcher. As a runner, he falls apart after like 5 or 6 carries.
Yep. Useless. I knew that pick. Like, that was easy to tell coming out of college.
Yeah, so it's all annoying, but again, I do mean to, and I'm not even blaming Allen for this either. I think it's something to do with the structure, the spread shotgun insistence, something about their actual infrastructure as an offense just makes it difficult for running backs. Maybe it's something to do like most running back targets, or a lot anyway, are kind of like of a check down sort. And when I try to recall Josh Allen dropping back to pass, he doesn't seem like a check down quarterback ever.
No.
Like, the closest he gets to checking down, it's like the slot rep, the Cole Beasley rep or whatever. Every time he throws to a running back that isn't in a scripted setup, like a screen kind of setup, I feel like it's more like the play is just dead and he's kind of like unloading the ball. You know? Like, so I'm not saying James Cook is actually responsible for that figure, but it is even worse than what Singletary put up. You know, it explains why Moss couldn't do anything as a pass catcher. And just as importantly as any of those things, if there is something to this, then it means they can't do anything about it. That they can either change the structure of the offense, they can change the order of Allen's progressions, but the idea that they just got to put a J.D. McKissick in there and that'll fix everything, like, that's nonsense. It's a structural issue, a structure that they built by choice.
I think that's the hardest truth about all of this is, like, do they really have the ability to adjust on the fly going into next year and really kind of like overhaul everything, or are they just going to run this back exactly the way that they did this year and last year and the year before and just hope that it's somehow a little bit different, despite, you know, the Chiefs being just as good if not better next year. The Bengals, obviously, they're not going anywhere. Jaguars are about to be a problem as well. It's hasty to say that the window's closed. I don't know if that's the case, but
it's at the very least, though, they could really use a dome is what they could use. They built this team as if they play in Los Angeles or Miami or something. Like, you are a Buffalo team. How is a Buffalo team? Do you have that Mac Jones game last year or this game in the playoffs where
pushed around?
We didn't have a chance. It was snowing outside. You're from Buffalo.
Yeah. Like, that was, I mean, if you're like a Buffalo fan, like, I feel like part of like the mystique is like, oh, we play somewhere that's like borderline uninhabitable.
We just got to avoid the first round. We got to avoid home field advantage. We got to play on the road in the playoffs so that we can get some decent weather.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know what the way forward is for the Bills, but I thought that was a good breakdown there. And then we
get better too. And sorry, I just want to say that I think I'm not blaming McDermott for this, but I do think that obviously if they had Von Miller, it could have been a different outcome. So snow, Von Miller, those two things, that could be enough for the Bills to get to the Super Bowl in an alternate timeline. But yeah, they got it. The run, it's also on the run defense that you see that ideology of indifference toward the run games. Like they couldn't.
You called that last week beautifully.
I mean, I didn't expect it to go like that. Otherwise, I would have tried to find a way to put money on the Bengals, you know. But yeah, it's like they're indifferent toward running the ball on offense, and it shows in the play calling and the personnel. And on defense, you don't really see it so obviously as in close games, because usually they, you know, Josh Allen just takes away the running option for the other team, and then it's no big deal. But if Josh Allen is not Josh Allen, it all falls apart, even the defense.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah, they got bullied a little bit. They, you know, you talked about their linebackers a little bit overrated, potentially smaller. And then, yeah, no Von Miller meant no pass rush. So therefore, you know, the big narrative going into last weekend's game was like, well, the Bengals are missing three of their starting offensive linemen. You couldn't tell at all.
Not to go into too much of a tangent, but a way you make a bad offensive line look less bad is by running a lot. Mm-hmm. And not just because it tires the defense and everything else, it's just an easier task to do, which is why you'll see on the Falcons roster this year, you're going to see some higher PFF grades than any of those guys have ever had in their lives, especially Caleb McGarry. And it's basically because they've started running the ball so much that the fact that he sucked as a pass blocker just started to not really matter much in practice. And
yeah,
it's not easy to, it's, you know, normally if you just run the ball and get no certain thing out of it, you're just making your own loss arrive that much sooner. But when you actually have the leverage on the field positioning and the flow of the game, like the Bengals did, it's a pretty reliable way to hide a bunch of bum linemen.
It sure is. We are at 50 minutes, so we should probably get into this weekend's game. Sorry, Cowboys fans. I'm sure you've heard and felt enough this week. We'll touch on the Cowboys.
We'll be fine, Cowboys fans. Don't worry about it. It's only been 30 years or whatever.
And it's, Next year is definitely
for sure the one, for sure.
But before we get into the conference championship matchups, a quick message from our friends over at Blue Wire.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this. But Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, let's get things rolling, Mario. Let's start off with the NFC Championship game. Kicks off at 3 o'clock Eastern time on Sunday. We got the Eagles, 2.5-point favorites against the 49ers. This line has not budged very much, if at all. Your thoughts on the spread there? Does that make sense? Is that about in line with where you'd see it over-under in this one, 46.5? So up about a point from where it was earlier in the week. So slight indication that there's going to be, you know, a little bit more scoring than we initially expected based on the total. But, you know, either way, a close game that we're expecting here with Philadelphia home team, of course, coming out on top.
Yeah, so I am not a bettor. I don't know any of the general rules that should be heeded, you know, about like road team of this spread, rookie quarterback, this spread, whatever. there might be to normally account for. So when I look at spreads, all I can really do is defer to the really inexact idea in my head about how roughly good they are. And I'm like, Eagles seem sure. Let's call it 2 points better. I don't know. Fine. Whatever. I don't disagree with it. There might be something that I should be able to notice there beyond that, but I don't. So it seems fine to me, but I am a little surprised that it's not three. I would have thought that the home field, 3 point rule would dictate that these would, as roughly even teams, or so I would have figured it would be just kind of, three for the Eagles. So I guess you could say if it's less than three for the Eagles, there's some amount of momentum, market momentum toward the 49ers. And despite, looking at the raw betting totals, it seems like most of the betting volume anyway, maybe not money, is on the Eagles. But sportsbooks do presumably have to keep in mind the public opinion anticipation on a line and how that affects.
It's about 80% on both the volume and the money as far as the Eagles go.
That's interesting.
That makes me like the Niners more.
Right. I feel like last week this rule would have applied to the the Bills, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the Bills were kind of getting that sort of action, and it, of course, didn't work out. But I do feel like it's something like 3/4 of the time in cases like this happen. It's the one where you're going, well, why aren't they betting on the other one a little bit more? And when the line doesn't move more in response, especially, it seems that way. So I'm nervous, but like last week, taking the Bengals anyway, nervously as I might have, I'm sticking with the Eagles. It's not that I want to pick against the 49ers. I really don't. In fact, a couple weeks ago, or, at least before Jimmy Garoppolo's injury, I would have picked the 49ers as my favorite to win the NFC. I just can't see it with Purdy. And I really am a Jimmy Garoppolo critic. I don't want to make it sound like I think there's some unbearable drop off from Garoppolo to Purdy, but Purdy has not done that much. And I don't mean that as a criticism of Purdy either. It's like, he almost went undrafted. He's a 7th round rookie. He shouldn't be asked to do much at all. So that he isn't doing much at all, I don't mean to make it sound like it's a failure on his part, but it's a reality that they can't get something out of him if they need it. Or at least if they do need something from Purdy, they're already pushing their luck. They're already getting into a dangerous place. And I think you see reliably over this short time that Purdy's been the starter, you see Kyle Shanahan correctly trying to hide him and trying to keep him underneath 30 pass attempts per game, trying to hide him a little bit during high leverage situations and trying to make as much of his work as a passer off of play action, off of other various, helpful setups. So, I do think that there's a pretty good chance in this game that the 49ers need the quarterback to do more than they've otherwise asked Purdy to do to this point. And if that happens, I just see that as trouble for the 49ers and not in any way that I would ever hold against Purdy. It's not lucky that he's gotten this far, but the degree to which it's improbable is not a reason to believe in him further. It's a reason to worry about regression or just kind of like reality, reappearing as you previously knew it. And so with Jalen Hurts, in my opinion, much more, it looks like the internet monster got John. I assume he'll be back soon. There he is. Whereas Jalen Hurts, in my opinion, is like a battle tested legitimate quarterback for a game like this. The 49ers just have to hide Purdy the whole time. And I guess it's possible they do that. I mean, if the 49ers defense is lights out and Jalen Hurts has a meltdown game as a passer, we know the 49ers run game can bludgeon anybody if enough time, but the Philadelphia run defense is a lot better than it was earlier in this year. Like Jordan Davis, Linval Joseph, and Ndamukong Suh, those guys definitely shore up the run defense, and in a game like this might be deployed even more than they normally would, and that might make things tougher to run for the 49ers than they're accustomed to, at which point, if it were to get to that point anyway, you're going to have Purdy and his pass catchers, Kittle, Debo, Ayuk primarily, they're going to have to do something against these this Eagles coverage apparatus, which has Darius Slay, James Bradbury outside. That's about as tough as it gets. And Chauncey Gardner-Johnson's probably better in the slot than Avante Maddox had been last year or most of this year. So I see a lot of trouble for most passing games against the Eagles, and it's just the 49ers are no exception. So I need the defense. I need the run game to bail out the offense, to offset that slack. And, I think it just comes down to Hurts. Like, Hurts, I do think, has limitations as a passer, and I do think you can get him to have some really rough games. Of course, last year especially, there were some games, entire halves of games where it's like Hurts just looked like he couldn't play in the league. And adding A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith being in the second year, that pretty much took care of that. But I think Hurts, limited or not, has about as much help as Brock Purdy does on the other side. And I just I'm worried about both quarterbacks, but I have to worry more about the rookie who basically went undrafted and is playing on the road in this game. So I think Purdy's tough. He's certainly poised. I mean, the one thing that he actually has at an elite level is poise. I don't think the setting is going to scare him that much, but it's kind of a lot for pretty much any quarterback, but especially a rookie, especially seventh round rookie, to go from a situation where everything is kind of favorable all the time and kind of helpful for you. And then all of a sudden the difficulty level goes up, not just as the pressure goes up, but it's like you got to go on the road too. I don't know. It seems like to me that the Eagles are a little maybe disrespected in the current spread, but I'm not exactly eager to pick a winner in this game. So it's not like I'm going to argue with anyone about if they were going with the 49ers there. I certainly don't want to underestimate them or overestimate the Eagles. I think it comes down to the quarterbacks, and simple reductive reasoning or not, I kind of prefer the veteran who's done a lot more lifting for his offense. It's like, that's the other thing. As much as Hurts has limitations, like, he does real lifting. He has certain weaknesses that you got to cover up. It's like, Purdy just kind of has to hang around and not do anything. And if they need him to do something, they might not like the results. So I'll go with the Eagles. I don't know what, I don't want to speak on John's behalf too much, but I would imagine he's kind of leaning the Eagles, but hopefully he can get online here and we can just ask him and I don't have to speculate on what he thinks. But I'm going to start moving on a little bit to this Chiefs-Bengals game just to kind of stay vaguely on our original schedule. Chiefs now listed on covers.com as +1. John, is that you?
Yeah.
Oh, John's back. John, who do you like in the Eagles? Oh.
Give me 1 second here.
Okay. All right. Oh, he's gone again. I think we can assume that the line being Kansas City +1 is 100% in recognition of Mahomes' injury, which is frustrating, of course. The timing of it is pretty annoying. You would have liked to have had this happen in September or something. But he's apparently practicing fully. I don't think that he really is, or at least if he has a high ankle sprain, he's not practicing fully. Maybe he doesn't actually have a high ankle sprain. I don't know. But if you have a high ankle sprain, you are not practicing fully. You're tinkering with the definition of what practice is. And it's basically he's probably doing walkthrough kind of stuff. So that's a real problem. It meaningfully inhibits their game preparation, their game planning. And as much as Mahomes is not truly a running quarterback, as much as he doesn't need the run threat to propel his passing numbers, there are still times in games, and I would imagine they happen even more in the playoffs, where the Chiefs offense just needs Mahomes to bail them out somehow. And in those situations, maybe they don't happen often, but when they do, we take for granted that Mahomes usually just breaks the pocket and gets a first down somehow, and then it goes back to the previous script. But what would happen if he doesn't get that first down? What happens to the script then? This game might kind of be the answer to that question, and I would much more like the Chiefs' chances of withstanding this injury if they had a competent run infrastructure. I don't think they do. I think that would really hurt them in this game. If Mahomes is limited, I just point blank take the Bengals because if there's any sort of slack, if there's any sort of lifting that needs to be done that Pat Mahomes can't do, it doesn't get done. There's not a, it's not a question. It just won't get done. So because they can't get anything on their ground game, even against weaker defenses, and because the Bengals run defense is probably one of the best right now, I think you're going to have a game where the Chiefs wish they could run the ball, kind of like the Bills, and they won't be able to, and they'll lose for it, is how I see it.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly plays into the Bengals' hands. I think, you know, Mahomes not being able to create outside of the pocket would be, you know, a huge detriment to just the shape and, you know, how they want to go about attacking this Bengals' defense. So, like you said, that you could see the direct parallels there where it's like if Mahomes isn't Superman, the way that Josh Allen wasn't Superman for the Bills, all of a sudden the Chiefs are in trouble. And, you know, we've seen that this line move a decent bit throughout the course of the week, where initially Chiefs come out favored, everyone hammers the Bengals. As a result, it climbs up to 2.5 points in favor of the Bengals. Now we're seeing
2.5. Oh wow!
It got up there. I mean, it was pretty crazy. But now, after Mahomes was able to put in like a full practice on Wednesday, the line has shifted back. But even if he's been able to practice, I mean, there's no way that he's going to be close to 100% with that type of injury.
Yeah, and I'm actually, the more I think about it, I'm getting more and more concerned that they listed him as a full practice participant. It's like, you're lying.
Yeah, it's like that's fake.
Yeah, it's like, he's not practicing fully, so what are you hiding? Like, if they just said, yeah, he's limited, I'd be like, yeah, probably is. But now they're like,
right,
he's fine, everything's perfect. In fact, he is 100% healthy. It's like, okay, that's trying a little too hard.
Yeah, yeah. So that struck me as odd, and yeah, I'm definitely concerned about him, and you know, certainly just the practice participation listing isn't really changing my views on this one. I thought that straight up, even if Mahomes was healthy for this one, I thought that I would give the Bengals a pretty good shot at winning this one. But yeah, with that injury, I think the Bengals are in.
Yeah, man, I will say I don't know what to make of the Chiefs' run defense. I mentioned before the Bengals Bills game that I kind of suspected the Bills were a fake run defense, and I kind of feel that way about the Chiefs too. But I will say their linebacker personnel is so much better this year than in recent years. Like, they'd have those annually bad Chiefs run defenses, but it'd always be like Anthony Hitchens and like Ben, what? What was that? Is Ben Neiman that one that like, it was like an Iowa guy or something?
Oh, sounds familiar.
Or Minnesota guy, crap, Big Ten linebackers. Like, those guys are not the linebackers that the Chiefs have now. Nick Bolton's done a good job. Willie Gay, I am, of course, still a Leo Chenault truther, but Willie Gay and what's his name? Bolton are way better than the Chiefs linebackers of yore.
No, they absolutely are. Bolton's really good difference maker for them. Local guy, Missouri. So love to see that. Beyond that, I mean, what is the way in which the Chiefs can ultimately win this game? I think there is a difference in the ability to make the Bengals pay for their offensive line injuries with Chris Jones and company than there was with Buffalo.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ed Oliver and Greg Rousseau are really disruptive, but they paid maybe a price for, at least Oliver maybe paid a price for being kind of light. And Chris Jones, you can get guys under him sometimes, maybe move him around a little bit, but he's certainly not light. And if you don't have that, if you don't have like a very competent leverage oriented blocker to stall him with, he can kind of wreck things. So I have no good sense of what to make of the Chris Jones factor. I mean, it's you always have to put him on watch for having just a total wrecker kind of game. And I guess he kind of did last year. What did he do against the Bengals last year? I feel like
I think he was going pretty crazy. But, you know, the Bengals, for their part, you know, were shutting down the Chiefs completely in the second half. And that kind of was the story of the game, really.
Yeah. Anyway, I am concerned about Chris Jones. I just short of him, I guess, like winning the game, I don't know how the Chiefs win it. I feel like Jones needs to have an incredible record game to do that, though. Like he'd need to wreck, not just single-handedly wreck the passing game of the Bengals. He would need to be able to make sure like they can't get any first downs and can't turn short fields into points reliably. So I don't know. I gotta go with the Bengals, and I don't mean to make it sound like I'm not giving the Chiefs a chance. It's just that I feel like almost every conventional consideration you'd make, you call it advantage Bengals, and it's Mahomes or not, it's just tough for any team. And I could just be, you know, making the wrong assessments in that, you know, itemization there, but I feel like it's, if we assume that it's correct to say that the Bengals have the advantages at quarterback, not because you don't have to believe Mahomes is as, or that Burrow's anywhere good as Mahomes. I don't, but Mahomes on a high ankle sprain, it's not just Burrow who's better. There's other quarterbacks who are better than Mahomes right now. And that's almost never the case. Otherwise, it's never the case for the Chiefs. Otherwise, they don't win when Mahomes is not Mahomes, you know? So I don't want to dismiss the Chiefs in the Arrowhead factors there. And I said earlier, like the Chiefs can't run. They can run with Pacheco, and they can do real actual running with Pacheco, but I don't know how much that scales up, and I don't know how good he is. And I don't know if he's really going to play up against a defense like this one. I feel like Pacheco, as much as I wrote some like apologia for him as a draft prospect, it was always while conceding, he's probably a horse blinder runner. You probably have to create the space for him. But if you do, what is left at that point other than the motor and the speed? You know, it's like if the space is cleared, I don't see how he doesn't go. This is one of those exceptions to that. This is more like, I don't see how the Bengals give him those lanes. And if he doesn't have those lanes, then I do worry about Pacheco just running into his own lineman over and over. And not just that, he's had a fumbling problem all year that hasn't gotten talked about much. And if you put an almost undrafted rookie running back onto something this important, the stakes of this situation, I wouldn't want a running back who had four fumbles on the year going over 15 carries in this game.
No, that definitely.
But they need him to. If he can't get the 15 carries, they can't compete, in my opinion.
So that sets up a tricky spot for the Chiefs, because yes, like it, no matter what Mahomes looks like through the air, they're still going to need to run it a little bit more than they have. This might be a good spot for you to get the last laugh on Jerick McKinnon. I feel like
I'm not laughing. I didn't pick him up for the designated uncovered guy role, and I should have known that would be a thing this year. But also, to be fair to myself, I did say all year long that if they try to do this stuff in the playoffs, they're going to pay for it. And I'm not happy that a Pat Mahomes injury might be the reason that turns out to be the case, but it sure looks like it could be.
Yeah,
because McKinnon's not doing anything. If they run with McKinnon, they lose fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, he's not getting past the second level there. And you know, if the field is kind of shrunk because of the Chiefs' inability to throw, then you get the safeties coming up. The safeties are getting run support. This becomes, you know, kind of a disaster scenario for Kansas
and
City.
What's funny, I think the Chiefs might have no idea what's coming for them. I think they really might believe like McKinnon's that good. Like they really do watch him just be uncovered over and over. Be like, wow, he's so good at being never covered. That must mean he's good. Let's not ask the defense about this.
And then I guess I missed a little bit of your Eagles,
I didn't mean to
Niners
speak
takes
too much on your behalf. So yeah, I was trying to ask you who you wanted, or not wanted, who you thought the Eagles 49ers game would favor.
I'm gonna go back and forth on that one basically until kickoff on Sunday. But my initial inclination is to go with the Niners. And I know the Niners didn't look as good last week as the Eagles did in their game, but they were obviously playing a worse opponent, in my opinion, obviously between the Giants and the Cowboys, duh. But I don't know. My problem with the Eagles a little bit has been, what do they look like when, you know, they get punched in the mouth a little bit, they get shown a little bit of adversity. And I don't mean to say that in the sense of like, well, they had to, you know, play part of the season with Jalen Hurts sidelined. I mean more in the game. You know, I keep going back to like the Washington Monday night game that they lost, where that, you know, they turned the ball over and their turnover differential was crazy before that game. And all of a sudden it's not going their way. And, you know, that they got beat by Washington. Again, I don't think it's necessarily a one-to-one clean comparison, but I do feel like the Niners aren't going to just kind of roll over in this spot. I feel like the Niners are going to force a lot of issues, I think, onto this Eagles team. And how the Eagles respond, I think, is going to tell the tale of this game. If they can, you know, absorb the body blows and keep going and do what they normally do, then they probably win. And I think that, you know, there's a chance that Brock Purdy turns into a pumpkin. That's obviously in the realm of possibility. But I also feel like the Niners have some fail safes built in. You'd like to see a fully healthy McCaffrey, a fully healthy Deebo Samuel to kind of help account for those things. But yeah, if Purdy isn't sharp, there's still ways for the Niners to be able to move the ball, in my opinion. So that plus the defense being as good as it is for the Niners, my lean is to go with San Francisco in this one.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. What I was saying was I pretty much don't want to pick a side, but if I had to, I'd pick the Eagles. The way that I think it could go wrong for the Eagles is if they basically force Jalen Hurts to, I don't know, they need him to throw and throw badly. I just don't know how they get that to happen is the concern that I have. For what it's worth, though, if Hurts is just slightly off, I think that's enough for the Eagles to fall apart because I don't think they're going to be able to run at all. I think if they try to run, they'll just get nothing for it but heartburn. So I think if they throw the ball aggressively and spread out the 49ers and test their corner depth, I like A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith carrying the offense in that case, carrying Hurts, if you need to call it that. But yeah, it's like on the 49ers side, if Purdy does nothing, they can still win. Whereas with the Eagles, if Hurts does nothing, they're just categorically over at that point.
Yep, I think so as well. Before we sign off here, I want to throw this at you and see if there's anyone that you would be interested in for the anytime touchdown scores for this weekend. So we'll avoid the guys that are minus money to get there, like a Christian McCaffrey, Travis Kelce, and so on. But any guys from this conference championship round that you could see getting into the end zone that you'd like to potentially throw a couple shekels on?
For the plus money specifically?
Yes.
That's tough because I feel like the Eagles offense especially is so reliably channeled. It's just like, can I bet on A.J. Brown or Devontae Smith at plus money? No? Okay. Well,
You can get a little bit of a value on Brown up to plus 155 over on FanDuel.
Okay, yeah, I'll take that. I mean, I think so part of why I went with the Eagles is that I do think A.J. Brown is pretty much an inevitable player. And I think Hurts is a little bit not that he's a fraud. He's not. I think he is carried as a passer, and A.J. Brown is the kind of receiver who, just because he's going against a conventionally tough matchup, doesn't necessarily matter to me. Like, I think if the quarterback is upright enough to throw the ball, A.J. Brown beats the corner he's against.
Yeah, no, he does. So that there's decent value on him. You can get Devontae Smith at plus 185 over on FanDuel. 2-1 for Dallas Goedert. I'm definitely interested in that. George Kittle, I feel like, is another good one. Plus 190 over at BetMGM. Let's see here. Deebo Samuel, plus 170 at a couple of books. That's pretty nice. Elijah Mitchell, a lot of variance on his, as high as plus 370 at FanDuel, but as low as plus 150 at BetMGM.
Sorry, 370, that's almost like one of those, is that like you don't even really need to believe that it's going to work kind of odds? Like you just kind of buy it for the odds alone?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, so Elijah Mitchell and Juwan Jennings are the guys I would say. Like, there's no reason to think either one scores specifically, but they're both capable. And it's like, sometimes touchdowns come down to not really the guy beating anybody as much as the defense kind of just missing them, you know? Like, you might see Juwan Jennings catch a wide open play action touchdown or something.
Yep, and you can get that at like 6-1 at a couple different spots. So that's certainly, if you're in the anytime touchdown market, keep an eye on that one, of course. That's going to wrap it up for us here. Apologies for the technical difficulties. Thank you, Mario, for running through the full NFC Championship breakdown with me, having a technological breakdown over here. I'm actually going to have to run over to my other computer to close out this show here. But again, for Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening to this edition of the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast.
Try RotoWire today, free for 10 days. Get our premium tools, rankings, analysis, and breaking news alerts. No credit card required. Go to rotowire.com/try.